Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into the stack of sources you provide, extract the most crucial legal and historical insights, and turn that complexity into clear, actionable understanding.
Today, we are taking on one of the most mysterious and frankly misunderstood institutions in the entire legal system.
The grand jury. I mean, most of us, when we hear that term, we think of a procedural mechanism, right?
Yeah, rubber stamp.
Exactly. A panel that meets in secret to, well, almost always confirm whatever the prosecutor wants.
It feels like this ancient relic that's just outlived its usefulness.
And that perception, that exact idea, is precisely the problem. According to the legal analysis we're diving into today, that perception is maybe the greatest act of misdirection in modern jurisprudence.
It really is. We are here to basically dismantle everything you think you know about this body.
Okay, so let's set the stage. We're working primarily from an exhaustive analysis by an author writing as Publius Custos, and the title is The Grand Jury as a Pre-Political Institution, a legal analysis of its natural law foundation and inherent independence.
And right away, that title tells you this is not a casual critique. This isn't about minor reforms.
Not at all. This source makes a central, and I mean absolutely shocking, claim that really frames our entire conversation.
Yeah.
So let's just put it on the table. What is the core thesis?
The shocking thesis is that the grand jury is not and never was a part of the government.
Not part of the government.
Not at all. It's not an appendage of the judiciary. It's not subject to the legislature. The source defines it as a pre-political institution.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning it existed and possessed authority superior to all three delegated branches of government. It's supposed to function as the ultimate constitutional check, the people's inherent check on state power.
Okay, superior to the government. That's not a footnote in legal history. That is a structural revolution.
It is.
And if it's supposed to be superior, but we all see it operating as basically the prosecutor's subordinate, what is the consequence of that?
The consequence, according to the source, is that the modern version of the grand jury is an illegitimate counterfeit.
A counterfeit?
Yes. It's been systematically captured, co-opted by the executive branch, the prosecutor, and is therefore fundamentally void ab initio.
Invalid from its very inception.
Invalid from the start as a regulated, government-controlled entity.
That is a profoundly bold and, I have to say, provocative claim. Because if the mechanism used to initiate nearly all federal felony prosecutions is legally void,
then what does that say about the system?
It calls into question the legitimacy of the entire criminal justice structure it supports. So our mission today is to understand this immutable hierarchy of law that supposedly places the institution beyond government control.
And to dissect the specific and what the source calls irrefutable evidence proving its capture.
All right, let's begin at the beginning then. If the grand jury is truly superior to the government, its authority must come from a higher form of law. You know, something more powerful than statutes or even the Constitution itself.
That's the only way it works.
So you mentioned this hierarchy of law. Where do we start?
We have to start not with the government's acts, but at the absolute supreme tier of law. The source argues that if any analysis of the grand jury begins with the Fifth Amendment or some state statute...
You've already lost the argument.
You've already lost because you're starting with derivative powers. This supreme tier is described as a firewall against governmental overreach.
And the fuel for this firewall is natural law. The source leans very heavily on William Blackstone. What did Blackstone establish about this original law?
Well, Blackstone was the definitive legal authority for the founding generation. I mean, his work was foundational. He defined the law of nature as something coeval with mankind.
Meaning as old as humanity itself.
Exactly. It's not mutable. It's not something we can change. And it's discoverable by human reason. But, crucially, Blackstone stated, it is superior in obligation to any other.
So this wasn't just a philosophical idea. It was a binding legal fact in the common law system.
A hard legal fact. So if it's superior, the implication is that any law enacted by man, a statute, a regulation, even a constitutional provision, has to conform to this original unalterable law.
Or else it's legally nullified.
Or it's null. That is precisely Blackstone's conclusion, and he was very explicit about it. He wrote that no human laws are of any validity if contrary to this.
And any valid laws get their authority from this original source.
Immediately and immediately, in his words. So the independence of the grand jury, therefore, isn't some, you know, political benefit granted by the state.
It's a natural law principle.
Pre-political and inherent to the liberty of the people.
Okay, so if its core functions come from these pre-political principles, let's get specific. What are the maxims of law that Sir Edward Coke called conclusions of reason, the things no government can override?
The source identifies two maxims that are legally devastating to the modern system we have today. The first one comes directly from the bedrock of modern liberty, Magna Carta, chapter 39.
Nemo accusatur nisi per judicium parium suorum.
No free man shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property, but by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the common law.
And what's the deep implication of that phrase?
It places the exclusive authority to bring a formal charge, the power of accusation, in the hands of the people. The peers.
Not the executive, not the crown, not the state.
Never. It is a fundamental shield against arbitrary power. So when the executive branch, you know, the prosecutor, usurps this role, the system loses its fundamental legitimacy right there.
And the second maxim, you said it was even more corrosive to the current structure.
It is. It's so simple. It's this foundational principle of natural justice. No one can be a judge in his own cause.
Right. You can't be the judge in your own case.
Exactly. This is cited from Branch's Prine and from Coke. Now think about the modern practice. The prosecutor, who is an agent of the executive government,
right,
is responsible for building the case, presenting the evidence, instructing the jury on the law, and arguing for the charge.
But hold on. The justification is that they are legally distinct from the grand jury, which is made up of citizens. Isn't the prosecutor just an advocate and the grand jury is the neutral judge of probable cause?
That is the modern justification, yeah. But the source argues it's a very thin veneer because the prosecutor is the only legal voice allowed in the room.
Mm-hmm.
They select the evidence, they guide the legal interpretation, and they often present only the facts supporting the accusation. So the government has effectively become the judge of its own cause.
Because it has an inherent interest in getting an indictment.
Of course. To justify its investigation, its expenditure, its political goals. By guiding the proceeding, the government is violating a core maxim of natural justice that precedes all written law. The prosecutor is not a neutral administrator.
They're an interested party.
A deeply interested party whose power is used to secure the very accusation they desire.
That makes the prosecutor's current role not just, you know, inappropriate, but a fundamental breach of pre-political law. The analysis connects this back to American constitutional law through Thomas Cooley's constitutional limitations.
Yeah, Cooley's work is critical here. It confirms that these foundational principles are not subject to political whim or popular vote.
He wrote that the Constitution ties up the hands of government officers and this is the important part.
The whole people as an aggregate body.
So you're saying the people themselves cannot vote away a foundational right?
That's what Cooley says. No. If natural law dictates that the power of accusation resides exclusively with the people's peers and that the state can't be a judge in its own cause,
then the people can't delegate a power they don't have. They can't authorize the government to violate those principles.
Precisely. Cooley confirms that neither the officers of the state nor the whole people are at liberty to take action in opposition to these fundamental laws. The implication is profound. Since the grand jury is an institution rooted in these untouchable superior principles, no branch of government has any lawful authority to regulate or alter its structure. Any statute claiming to do so is inherently null.
That sets up the structural argument perfectly. If the government truly lacks jurisdiction, we need the legal evidence of that boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Most people would look to the Fifth Amendment.
Right, that's the natural place to start.
What does it establish and how does the source interpret its silence?
So the Fifth Amendment states that no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Now, the critical legal analysis here, and this is where a lot of scholars miss the mark, according to the source,
okay,
is that the Fifth Amendment did not create the grand jury power. It merely recognized and preserved an ancient right.
So it's a shield, not a grant of power to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
It confirms a pre-existing right.
A pre-existing common law right. It doesn't delegate any regulatory authority over that right to the government. And this brings us to the core legal argument.
Which is casus omissus, the doctrine of intentional silence.
Casus omissus. It literally means omitted case. Blackstone, when he was describing this doctrine, noted that when the law is silent on a particular subject like, say, the qualifications or duties of grand jurors,
that silence isn't an oversight.
It is not an oversight to be corrected by the legislature. He argued the silence is intentional and cannot be supplied by legislative invention.
That's fascinating. So if the Constitution is silent on granting Congress regulatory power over the grand jury, that silence is interpreted not as a blank space,
but as a jurisdictional barrier.
Keep out sign.
Exactly. It establishes a zone of untouchable power reserved to the people. And to illustrate this, the source brings in Thomas Paine's political theory from Rights of Man.
Paine insisted that a constitution is not the act of a government, but of a people constituting a government.
The government is a mere trustee of delegated powers. It holds power and trust for the people.
And Paine makes that critical distinction regarding those powers.
He does. He says all power must be either delegated or assumed. What the people did not explicitly delegate remains beyond all governmental reach.
And he warned that all delegated power is trust, and all assumed power is usurpation.
So by this standard, any government action regulating the grand jury is, by definition, assumed power, not delegated power. And time doesn't make usurpation legitimate.
I understand the theory of reserved power, but surely in American law, we've had times where constitutional silence did allow for discretion. How do we reconcile this very strict reading?
We reconcile it by looking at Alexander Hamilton, of all people. He confirmed this rule in Federalist No. 83. Hamilton drew a crucial distinction between two types of silence.
Okay.
In criminal cases, the Constitution explicitly mandates trial by jury that binds the legislature. But in civil cases, there was, in his words, total silence in the Constitution regarding the right to a civil jury.
And in that case, for civil juries, Hamilton argued the legislature's discretion was left at large.
Yes. But see the difference. The civil jury was not mandated by the Constitution, nor was it confirmed as a pre-existing common law, right in the same protective, restrictive language.
Ah, I see. The grand jury, being confirmed by the Fifth Amendment, represents a right the people preserved from the common law and withheld from the government's power.
Precisely. Hamilton's rule confirms that silence grants discretion only when delegation is ambiguous. Here, the reservation of the right, coupled with the lack of delegated regulatory power, creates a prohibition.
So if we tie all these threads together, the natural law, Paine's delegated power, Hamilton's distinction, the conclusion is that the grand jury exists as a constitutional casus omnibus.
A permanent, untouchable institution.
Forever outside the jurisdiction of Congress or the states.
That is the source's core jurisdictional argument. Any statutory scheme, state or federal, that tries to create or limit or regulate grand juries.
By setting terms, telling them the law.
Appointing prosecutors as their legal advisors. All of it is ultra vires, beyond power, and therefore void. The government was never delegated the authority to control its principal, and that omission is jurisdictional.
So if the grand jury is untouchable, let's explore what the people originally designed this institution to do, what it was meant to control. We have to look at the historical design, which starts in 1215.
With Magna Carta.
Right.
And Magna Carta, Chapter 39, it's not a document that's granting rights from the king. It's a document restricting the sovereign.
It's a limitation on power.
An absolute restraint on the king's power.
Yeah.
It guaranteed that the sovereign could not prosecute or imprison a free man arbitrarily. So the grand jury was created to limit this state, not to assist it.
And this leads us to that critical maxim from Sir Edward Coke that you mentioned, which just, it utterly demolishes the modern role of the prosecutor.
And it really is the historical sledgehammer. Coke's statement is so succinct. The grand jury may present their own knowledge. The king's attorney is but a witness.
Wait, I need to make sure I'm getting the full weight of that. If the prosecutor is only a witness,
then they're just someone who provides evidence. That's it.
No supervisory role, no authority to advise on the law, no power to direct the proceedings.
None. Zero. The grand jury is self-acting. The king's attorney, if he was needed at all, would be called in, sworn as a witness like anyone else, and then dismissed.
Leaving the people's inquest to deliberate on their own.
Independently. The concept of the prosecutor running the show, instructing on statutes, serving as the legal advisor, it's not just a deviation. It is a total inversion of the common law relationship.
And it violates that maxim about not being a judge in your own cause.
Absolutely. Then Sir William Blackstone comes along, and he codifies the full functional design in his commentaries. This is the famous distinction between the sword and the shield.
So tell us about those two historical functions.
So the grand jury was a twofold instrument of popular sovereignty. The first function was presentment. This is often called the sword of the people.
The sword.
This was the notice taken by the grand jury, acting entirely on its own knowledge or observation against offenses or, and this is the most critical part, against corrupt or oppressive officials.
All without any bill or prosecutor.
Without anyone from the government involved, it was the power of the people to initiate charges against the government itself.
So the sword was the people's mechanism for independent investigation and accusation, completely overriding the executive branch.
Precisely. It was the power to expose and prosecute misconduct by sheriffs, tax collectors, judges, anyone in a position of power. Now, the second function was indictment. This was the shield.
The protective function.
The safeguard. The formal written accusation that required 12 at least of the jurors to be thoroughly persuaded of the truth of the accusation. This acted as the necessary barrier to protect the innocent from arbitrary prosecution by the Crown.
Blackstone then combined these two roles and called the grand and pitted juries the strong and twofold barrier of English liberty.
He defined it structurally. The grand jury stands as the first barrier, preventing the government from even prosecuting without the consent of the people.
And the pitted jury is the second barrier.
Right, preventing a government from convicting without the judgment of the people. Both accusation and conviction are irrevocably reserved to the community.
To prevent the arbitrary use of state power.
Yes. And the source argues that the modern betrayal stripped the people of the sword, that power of presentments, and it corrupted the shield, turning the grand jury into an instrument of power, not a barrier against it.
It inverted the entire mechanism.
Completely. A system where the prosecutor chooses the evidence, instructs on the law, and secures the charge is, well, it's a system where the executive branch can weaponize the power of accusation against citizens.
While remaining immune from the people's own power of investigation.
That is the very tyranny Blackstone warned the grand jury was created to prevent.
And it's important to remember, this historical interpretation, it's not confined to ancient common law. Even modern legal minds recognize this unique status.
That's a key point. Justice Antonin Scalia classified the grand jury as a constitutional fixture in its own right.
And he defined it as functioning essentially as
a fourth branch of government outside the control of the judicial, legislative, and executive.
A fourth branch. That is the perfect modern summary of the source's argument.
It's a supervisory body, a permanent, powerful ombudsman that stands separate from and superior to the three branches it's designed to keep in check.
And the moment it ceases to be separate, it ceases to be a check.
It becomes a tool.
Okay, so if that was the original self-acting model, let's look at the specific mechanisms the source says were used to systematically usurp this power. Historically, colonial grand juries were incredibly independent.
They were the engine of resistance in colonial America. I mean, grand juries routinely issued presentments against crown officials, sheriffs who overcharged fees, justices who were corrupt.
Tax collectors enforcing unjust policies.
Exactly. And crucially, they refused to indict citizens under oppressive English laws like the Stamp Act. They operated entirely independently, often investigating and bringing charges before the king's attorney even knew what was happening.
The modern system is just. It's a radical, almost unrecognizable departure from that tradition.
A complete departure.
So the first major instrument of this usurpation is the assault on the shield. Prosecution by information. 46 states allow this, where a government attorney's unilateral accusation just replaces the grand jury process entirely.
The source views this as a direct, hostile assault on that fundamental maxim that accusation must come from one's peers. Blackstone had a deep historical suspicion of this practice.
He saw it as a relic of prerogative power.
Something inherently hostile to liberty. And he didn't just dislike it. He linked it to historical abuses under Henry VII and the infamous Star Chamber.
Right.
He wrote that informations were a mechanism used to harass the subject and shamefully enrich the crown. When a prosecutor files an information, they bypass the need for communal verification.
What Blackstone called the stamp of verisimilitude.
Right. It allows the state to initiate criminal power without any check from the people. To go from indictment by 12 peers to an accusation by one government lawyer is to fundamentally replace the people with the state.
Inverting the constitutional order.
Yeah.
The second instrument deals with state constitutional provisions that claim to allow legislatures to abolish or suspend the grand jury. The source calls these the legislative kill switches.
And this is a powerful structural argument. The source says these kill switches are legally non-operative. They just don't work.
Because the legislature cannot abolish what it did not create and does not own.
Correct. They cite Alexander Hamilton in Federalist No. 78. No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. To deny this would be to affirm that the deputy is greater than his principal.
Okay, but let me challenge that for a second. Surely a state constitution, representing the will of the people today, can amend its foundational documents and structure its legal system as it sees fit.
The source argues that foundational law, derived from these natural principles and preserved by the federal constitution, is a non-negotiable minimum requirement. Justice Patterson in Van Horn's Lessee v. Dorrance in 1795 made this crystal clear.
What did he say?
He said the Constitution is paramount to the power of the legislature. The legislature is a created body of temporary delegates. It cannot alter foundational structures, like the necessity of a popular check on accusation that predate and stand above it.
So any legislative attempt to alter or abolish the grand jury is ultra-vires.
Void ab initio and legally non-existent under the higher controlling principles.
Which means that in any state that relies on prosecution by information, the mechanism replacing the grand jury is itself operating under a legally null provision.
That is the claim. It's a house of cards. The grand jury is protected by the Fifth Amendment, and the structure of liberty cannot be revoked by the entity it was created to control.
So finally, let's look at the specific federal mechanism of capture. If Congress has no enumerated power in the Constitution to regulate the grand jury, how do they embed the executive branch into the process?
Well, Congress enacted Title 18 of the U.S. Code, sections 3331 to 3334. The source argues these statutes are the specific mechanism that created the fiat, court-supervised, prosecutor-run grand jury.
And how do they do that?
These acts empower judges to convene the grand jury, and critically, they empower U.S. attorneys to act as the legal advisor.
And by doing that, they systematically replace the independent people's court with what is essentially a bureaucratic appendage of the Department of Justice.
That's the argument. Since the grand jury is a pre-political body, Congress had no constitutional authority to grant the executive branch control over it. The source views this entire federal statutory structure as illegitimate.
Creating a system that's regulated, commanded, and controlled by the very parties it was designed to restrain.
Exactly.
The legal architecture is one thing, but the most damning evidence, according to the source, is found in the government's own instructional materials. These handbooks, given to jurors, are described as confession of widespread constitutional violations.
They systematically manufacture ignorance. It's the only way the system works.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the federal handbook. The source points to one statement as a single-handedly admitted overthrow of 800 years of jurisprudence.
And what is that statement?
The handbook informs federal grand jurors. Much of the grand jury's time is spent hearing testimony presented by a government attorney.
Wait a minute. If you hold that up against Koch's maxim, the king's attorney is but a witness. That one sentence explicitly admits that the time, the scope, the direction of the people's inquest is now controlled by the executive branch.
It confesses to total subjugation. And this same pattern is repeated everywhere. State handbooks tell jurors the prosecutor will advise the grand jury on the law, or that they must assist the prosecutor.
They universally reverse the relationship. The servant, the prosecutor, is now in command of the master, the people's inquest.
Right. Jurors are often told to seek the prosecutor's permission before investigating anything, which is, I mean, that's the institutional death of the sword right there.
Let's dive deeper into the case study provided on New York, because the source uses this to highlight just how meticulously this constitutional sabotage is done. New York Constitution Article 1, Section 6 is described as a constitutional sledgehammer.
It's incredibly strong.
What are the three protections that make it so powerful?
So New York, maybe more than any other state, codified this common law supremacy. First, it permanently constitutionalizes the grand jury, so the legislature can't abolish it. Second, it forever preserves the grand jury's independent inquisitorial power over public officers.
The explicit preservation of the sword.
Exactly. And third, it declares that this power shall never be suspended or impaired by law.
That seems ironclad, almost impossible to subvert.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the official New York Grand Jurors Handbook deal with this constitutional mandate?
Through systematic, deliberate omission and misdirection. The handbook never even mentions the phrase investigative power over public officers.
So it just hides it.
It hides it. Instead, it frames the grand jury's job as merely determining whether the prosecutor's evidence is sufficient. It completely conceals their independent power to investigate or to subpoena their own witnesses.
And the handbook directly replaces the grand jury's ancient role as judge with the prosecutor's instruction.
Without a doubt. The instruction states, quote, "Your legal advisors are the district attorney or the assistant district attorney. Any questions you have about the law should be addressed only to the prosecutor."
A direct, open violation of Koch's maxim. The prosecutor is only a witness.
But the handbook makes the servant the master. It transforms the grand jury from a legal check into an administrative processing unit.
What about the crucial power of nullification? The right to no bill and indictment, not because of a lack of evidence, but because the law itself is unjust or being applied maliciously.
Completely erased. The chief judge's letter that opens the handbook limits the jury's decision to one question. Is the evidence sufficient or not sufficient? That's it.
There's no mention of judging the law's validity or rejecting a charge based on justice or mercy or political persecution.
Nothing. The power to reject tyrannical laws, the historical core of the grand jury, is structurally removed from their decision-making.
Let's just list out the full set of maxims that are still legally binding under New York's Common Law Preservation Clause, but are openly violated by these handbooks.
Yeah, the side-by-side comparison is just, it's stark. First, the maxim. The grand jury is the people's panel. The prosecutor is a mere witness.
The handbook violation. The district attorney is your legal advisor.
Next, the maxim. The grand jury is judge of both law and fact. They can judge the justice of the statute itself.
The handbook violation. The prosecutor instructs the grand jury on the law, stripping them of that power.
Then the principle. Grand jurors may refuse to indict for any reason of conscience, regardless of probable cause.
The violation. The decision is limited only to whether the evidence is sufficient. The shield function is eliminated.
And finally, the maxim. The grand jury may present any crime on its own knowledge, the sword.
The handbook violation. Zero instruction on presentments or their power to investigate public officials. It's just erased. Every historical power that made the grand jury a fearsome check on state power is systematically neutralized.
It is.
And the ultimate quantifiable proof of this capture is the indictment rate. What is that rate, and why does that statistic prove the institution has stopped functioning independently?
The source calls the indictment rate irrefutable empirical proof of capture. Across basically all jurisdictions, grand juries now return true bills in excess of 99% of all cases presented.
99%. The source cites rates between 99.2 and 99.97%.
I mean, a 99% success rate for the government isn't justice, it's mechanical ratification.
If you present 100 cases, 99 of them result in an indictment. It doesn't matter what the facts are, what the jurisdiction is.
That statistical uniformity proves that independent human judgment is absent. The decision has been made by the executive before the grand jury even convenes. The system relies on what we talked about earlier, verisimilitude.
The illusion of truth.
The prosecutor gets to cherry-pick evidence, withhold exculpatory evidence, and present this one-sided narrative that is, of course, inherently plausible because the jury never hears the other side. The process guarantees the outcome.
If the grand jury were truly exercising its historical powers, judging the law, rejecting malicious prosecutions, that 99% rate would be impossible. It would plummet.
It would have to. And the source cites that 1614 ruling from Sir Edward Coke, the case of the Taylors of Ipswich. Coke established that when an act of parliament is against common right and reason, the common law will control it and adjudge such act to be void.
This ancient principle of law judging power.
It must apply to modern victimless crimes engineered by licensing boards and regulatory cartels. The modern grand jury is failing precisely because it is not applying Koch's rule.
So let's talk about the human cost. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of victimless regulatory crimes indicted every year. The source gives two vivid case studies that really bring this home.
The first is Jesus Chuy Martinez, the Texas barber. Here's a man laid off from construction during the pandemic, trying to feed his family by cutting hair in his garage.
No complaints, no health violations, just a guy trying to work.
But the state has criminalized unlicensed barbering, requiring 1,500 hours of expensive schooling he couldn't afford.
And the county prosecutor, using this captured grand jury, escalated this act of harmless labor into a state jail felony.
The grand jury, under the prosecutor's guidance, returned a true bill in 12 minutes. The consequence for Mr. Martinez, 78 days in jail, the loss of his apartment, his wife forced onto welfare.
And his resulting felony record now permanently bars him from ever getting the license the state claimed he needed.
It's a complete trap. The grand jury, designed to protect the poor and vulnerable, was used to crush an honest man for engaging in harmless labor. Koch's ruling demands this indictment should be declared void.
The second case, Elijah Blue, the Mississippi fisherman, is even more heartbreaking.
Mr. Blue was a 62-year-old retired mill worker. He was catching catfish in a local stream to feed his five orphaned grandchildren.
And he lacked a $15 commercial permit.
A fact they discovered while he was in the hospital for severe diabetes complications. The district attorney, using the captured process, escalated this to felony illegal commercial fishing.
The indictment was ratified in 10 minutes. The system was frictionless.
Elijah Blue spent 4 months in jail. His grandchildren were hospitalized for malnutrition because their provider was locked up over a $15 fee. Mr. Blue suffered a stroke in custody and died from complications. His grandchildren were scattered into foster care.
And the source points to this as the direct consequence of the 99% indictment rate, a statistic that transforms the grand jury from a shield into a pair.
A private collection agency for regulatory agencies punishing people for trying to work.
So the analysis we've covered suggests the modern grand jury is void ab initio, an illegitimate counterfeit. If that's true, then traditional approaches, legislative reform, judicial appeal, they're not going to work.
They can't. You cannot fix a structure that never legally existed in the first place. The only path forward is reclamation.
That is the source's core thesis on the remedy. The institutional failure wasn't due to, you know, a military defeat or some sudden legal abolition. It was manufactured.
Through an education crisis. The deliberate concealment of the jury's true inherent powers. The solution, therefore, has to lie in restoring the knowledge and the courage of the people.
But let me challenge that. How can citizens lawfully convene a grand jury that is independent of the court system? I mean, if judges and prosecutors wield state power, how can a group of private citizens overcome that authority without it just being chaos?
The source argues that the true grand jury still exists as a matter of law. Its power is undiminished. Since the power comes from the people and the ancient oath, not from a government statute, lawful convocation requires only qualified members and the administration of that oath.
Independent of government permission.
Exactly. This is why the source emphasizes education first. Knowing that the statutory structures, the federal codes, the state codes, are void ultra vires means they hold no legal weight against the common law grand jury.
So let's detail the five stages of reclamation that the source says citizens can undertake.
Stage one is educate. This means fully absorbing the hierarchy of law, understanding the casus omissus, the natural law foundation, the original sword and shield powers. Jurors must know their allegiance is to conscience and fundamental law, not the local prosecutor.
Stage two is assemble. Citizens convene true common law grand juries in their counties. This is done by collecting the required number of qualified citizens, historically 23 people, and administering the ancient oath, bypassing the court's fiat system entirely.
Stage three is present. This is the moment they reclaim the sword. The lawfully assembled grand juries must use their inherent power of presentment to initiate self-initiated accusations.
Specifically directed against officials enforcing the void system.
Yes. Prosecutors, judges, lawmakers who are either enforcing this void statutory system or engaging in public corruption and oppression, they must reclaim the power to investigate the government.
Stage four is enforce. Once a presentment is issued, it is a formal accusation from the people. These presentments have to be published publicly and delivered to governing bodies.
And critically, to county peace officers, the local sheriff, to reassert lawful authority and demand a stop to the unconstitutional acts listed in the presentment.
And finally, stage five is restore.
The overall goal is to restore the hierarchy of law by demonstrating that this statutory house of cards only stands because the people are ignorant of their ultimate power. Once the true common law grand jury begins to investigate and publish presentments, the source argues the void statutory system loses its presumption of legitimacy and collapses.
The entire system survives only on the presumption of legitimacy and the manufacturing of ignorance. That's a powerful idea. Let's close by reciting that ancient oath, the solemn commitment that defines the juror's proper allegiance.
The common law oath, it doesn't mention the judge, the prosecutor, or the state. It binds the juror to a higher power and their conscience. You shall diligently inquire and true presentment make of all such matters and things as shall be giving you in charge or otherwise come to your knowledge touching the present service.
You shall present no one through envy, hatred, or malice. Neither shall you leave any unpresented through fear, favor, affection, or hope of reward.
You shall present the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God.
That oath places the grand juror above the political fray and squarely in the service of fundamental law, conscience, and truth.
It does.
We've taken a profound deep dive today, fundamentally challenging the conventional understanding of the grand jury. We established its foundation in natural law, recognizing it as a pre-political entity beyond government control, thanks to the doctrine of casus omissus.
We explored its original design as the sword and shield, the people's twofold barrier against oppression, confirmed by Koch and Blackstone.
And we detailed the devastating evidence of its modern capture. The unconstitutional nature of state and federal statutes, the self-confession of control found in juror handbooks.
And that shocking empirical proof of the 99% plus indictment rate, which has resulted in catastrophic human costs for individuals like Cheese Martinez and Elijah Blue.
The source material concludes that the grand jury still exists as a matter of law, its power undiminished, waiting to be reclaimed. We've discussed that the remedy is not legislative or judicial appeal, but direct lawful action by the people.
To reclaim this fourth branch through education and assembly, and this raises a critical, provocative question for you, the listener, to consider. If the grand jury is indeed the people's ultimate check on governmental power, superior to all three branches, and if the existing government depends on the people's ignorance of this power to maintain its captured structure, what is the ultimate consequence for law and liberty if citizens fail to reclaim this essential check?
If the people neglect their duty to wield the sword of presentment, who then remains to audit and restrain the servant,